I'd like to thank the organizers very much for the invitation to come to this event, which I've benefited from a great deal. The conversation, not only in the papers that have been given, but the questions and the side events and this kind of a thing have been really not only informative, but have been actually quite moving for me. So many aha moments of encountering a similar principle or spirit in another setting, whether it's listening to the Calvinists in Edmonton or the Lutherans, or indeed here and there with these new Muslim friends. It's been a great benefit, and I just want to congratulate the Ronning Center and David for the vision that brought this together, and Faris Kaya and others who have come a great distance to share with us the richness of their traditions. The paper that, the topic, as you know, that we've been asked to address in this panel is what lessons can be drawn from a concrete and recent example within each tradition of its way of responding to the struggles found in the communities of another tradition. Now, actually, I could have gone straight to examples of how, from within Roman Catholicism, that community has tried to assist in understanding principles, particularly, that other traditions would benefit from. But I thought it would be actually more helpful if I sort of set out some of the architecture, the social architecture from within the Catholic tradition, which could be illustrative as to why the Catholic insights are potentially helpful in engaging some of what I want to describe as I set out that architecture. To why that's helpful to other traditions. In some respects, the Roman Catholic community, for reasons of history, for reasons of holding philosophy and theology together, you know, it's been said philosophy is the handmaiden of theology. And I think what that means is that in some respects it's able to act as a link between theological conceptions and the culture around it in a philosophical language that doesn't betray the theological ground, but in some respects creates a means of connection that some of the traditions don't have to the same extent because they either haven't kept the philosophical traditions as closely to their theology, or they set themselves up in part against that philosophical tradition. I mean, that's the conclusion I came to as a Protestant for why it was my tradition didn't say much about the structure of civil society, for example. So it was interesting in Edmonton to encounter the Kyperians, who have their conceptions of sphere sovereignty, and see in that a kind of a similar development to what Roman Catholics understand as subsidiarity and so forth, a concept that Mark Charlton touched on yesterday. So there are commonalities within these different Christian communities, and I imagine within Orthodoxy and within Islam. Where there aren't, it's probably time to suggest that some of these, if they're true, need to be actually incorporated within the other traditions for reasons of engagement and understanding the position of each tradition in the context of contemporary cultures. Of course, there's going to be adjustments from society to society, but what I want to flesh out now is what I called the social architecture is, I think, extremely helpful in keeping certain things in view as we try and move from that wonderfully, beautifully developed mystical ground that was developed in the papers yesterday to the, in a sense, the practical world of the state understood as politics and law, and as it relates to the associational life of religions and communities. Because that's where the tension is today. The tension is, how do these different associations functioning within nation states find language to preserve their own identity against increasing pressures from the state level of law and politics through the subsidium, down through the associational life, all the way to the person. By way of sort of digression at the outset, let me just say that it's intriguing that contemporary rights theory is grounded on the notion of the individual, the autonomous, autonomos, self-law of the individual, in contradistinction to the idea of the person, understood as necessarily relational. You see, the language of rights is not the language of love. Love is necessarily relational. Rights is not necessarily that language at all. In fact, it can be said it isn't in really any way that language. So how do these communities that speak primarily the language of the person and love find place within these statist structures of the individual and rights? That's a question I put out there, and perhaps some of the conceptual framework that I'll articulate in the next few minutes will be helpful to think about those two worlds, the worlds that I'm now calling, as of this week, impositional and propositional frameworks. It was a thought that came on the plane on the way here, and it caused me to lose a lot of sleep as I rewrote my paper from beginning to end to accommodate this, what I hope is a useful set of insights. I'm certainly finding it fruitful, and I hope some of that fruit will be evident in what I now share with you. So I'd like to tentatively suggest that what Roman Catholicism understands as subsidiarity and solidarity can really be well understood and usefully understood in contradistinction to what we could tentatively refer to as systems of imposition and systems of proposition. Imposition is what law is about. Law imposes a set of oughts. Proposition, religion at its best, is a statement of towards freedom. It's an invitation to adopt, not an imposition. So if that's right, then how does the state as imposition, law and politics, understand itself in relation to associations of proposition? Because if love is essentially propositional, and I think our theologies say that love is a free gift in which we're invited to participate. Love ceases to be love when it's imposed. So if the state as rights an individual and the associations of proposition, love, and invitation collide, how are we to deal with that collision? What are the structures within which we're to understand this collision? And then I want us to put those set of questions in relation to the idea of theocracy. Because theocracy is all about mixing the state as law and politics with religion. Now, Jacques Maritain, in one of his books, refers to atheistic theocracy. And he puts on the table the idea that relationship between power and governance isn't just limited to religions. It's also limited to any belief system. And atheism is certainly a belief system, as is agnosticism. And one of the realizations that we have to make, I think, is increasingly that the public order is best understood as a realm of competing belief systems, not as something that we call secular, within which is implicit that it's somehow non-religious. If the secular realm, which used to be the order of time, secularum, in contradistinction to eternity, if the secular is understood as law, politics, medical ethics, public education, and all of those sorts of things, and it's defined as non-religious, then we've bracketed religion out of the public order. And yet one of the dimensions of religion, as understood in constitutional democracies, is that it has a public place. In the leading Canadian decision, Big M Drug Mart, Chief Justice Dixon said, the right to the freedom of religion isn't just the right to hold a belief in private, but the right to teach it, manifest it, disseminate it. So the individual, the person who holds a religious belief, is not just a private citizen, they have a public place. How does that square with our use of secular as a stripped public realm with religion outside of it? And if you think of the formulation religion and the secular, which is ubiquitous, used by ecclesiastical officials, clerics, religious believers, as much as by non-religious believers, you can see the problem. Secular in that construction is effectively guaranteeing the privatization of religion or the removal of religion from its proper public engagement. The Catholic Church challenges the state in setting limits of law and politics with a view of ordering that is not just for herself. The Catholic Church also challenges religion not to overreach in relation to the state, and the state not to overreach in relation to religion. It's fair to say this has been a very long road of learning, one that is still very much in process. It's a human road, not just a Roman Catholic road. Every human community sooner or later must develop a sense of the nature and limits of imposition in relation to the freedom-affirming aspects of proposition. Transcendence is always in tension with immanence, just as time is always in some sort of relationship with eternity. As Socrates' great Theban tragedy, Antigone, dramatically portrayed over 2,500 years ago, we might say that, in a sense, Antigone is always offering witness to Creon and what that struggle between transcendental principle and state power of law and edict shows us is that both need each other, but that chaos results when the jurisdictions get confused. Antigone's duties from the gods and Creon's claim to be all the law that there is echo through the ages and are spelled out down to today in what we might call the theocratic temptation to rule the state by religion and religion by the state. This struggle has been the base, the human ground, out of which the long centuries of experience and contest have forced Catholic insights, but in the end, they are also human insights for all communities. I'd like to engage this question of theocracy within Islam and do it over some period of discussion, because I think it's very important. Within Christianity, there are still groups of Christians who, if they could, would rule their little societies, their state, by biblical edict. Less of them all the time, partly in view of the kind of cultures within which Christianity is currently operating. But within Catholicism, the development of the church's pulling away from the power to rule the state Catholicly was one of the most contentious debates in the Second Vatican Council, leading up to the document Dignitatis Humanae, coming out of the work of the American Jesuit John Courtney Murray. And in that document, the Catholic Church developed its doctrine. That's the other thing I want to refer to. How do these religious traditions, how does Islam understand development of doctrine? Because if these insights about religious faith in relation to politics are developmental, what resources within Islam allow for that understanding and indeed can pull it, roll it forward and develop it? Because like plate tectonics, dialogue provides a means of releasing tension. Development provides a means of releasing tension. And if there's no ability to release it in smaller shocks, one can only imagine that eventually it leads to much greater shocks. What do we mean by civil society? In every area of society today, there's a need to discuss the proper roles of the various disciplines that make it up. By civil society, I mean the many forms of community and association that make up the social architecture of democratic cultures. Charles Taylor has said this of civil society: It's a web of autonomous associations independent of the state, which bound citizens together in matters of common concern, and by their mere existence or action could have an effect on public policy. He says, in this sense, Western liberal democracies were thought to have functioning civil societies. He compares this with what he calls the strongest alternative view to civil society models, and that's the Marxist-Leninist model, which arose first in the Soviet Union, but was then picked up in a number of newly formed third world countries. Taylor points out that the essential virtue of this model of Marxist-Leninist structuring was said to be that it offered a kind of total mobilization of society toward what were seen as revolutionary goals. The central instrument was a vanguard party dominated by a revolutionary elite. And a crucial feature of this system was the satellization of all aspects of social life to this party. Trade unions, leisure clubs, even churches all had to be permeated and made into transmission belts of the party's purposes. Leninism in its heyday was one of the principal sources of modern totalitarianism. Now, religions can be like that. Religions can have that vanguard party dimension in which they seek to dominate all aspects of the culture through imposition. Religious growth of associational life would do it not through a vanguard elite, but through perhaps an organizational framework that would teach towards a goal through proposition. Taylor notes that, and it's key to this paper, the most thoroughgoing destruction of civil society has been carried out in the name of some variants and successors of this idea of the vanguard party in the 20th century, notably the nation and the proletariat. A strange and horrifying reversal has taken place whereby an idea whose roots lie in a pre-political concept of society can now justify the total subjection of life to an enterprise of political transformation. And in less spectacular form, the power of the state has often been enhanced by its self-definition as an instrument of the national will. Nationalism. Interestingly, you pointed out, Faris Kaya and others did, that Nursi rejected nationalism. This is very interesting because nationalism, as with theocracy, is one of the great identifying temptations of power and imposition. The ummah, or the identification with a brotherhood, a global brotherhood and sisterhood that Christians would speak of, identifying that in Christ, is a challenge to nationalism. And that's, I think, a parallel that is useful to talk about and develop as well. Key to the notion of civil society is the idea of mediating institutions and mediating structures. And what are these? These are defined as the institutions that stand between the individual person in his or her private life and large institutions of public life. Now, the Catholic Church herself has in her long history experienced encounters with just about every imaginable variant of relationship between law, politics, and religion. We could be here for months, if not years, examining what is available, but I'd like to touch on a couple of useful points. First of all, that the Second Vatican Council encouraged mutually beneficial cooperative relationships between the church and state in the following terms. The council document, and I'm quoting here from Gaudium et Spes, said, "It is highly important, especially in pluralistic societies, that a proper view exist of the relationship between the political community and the church. Thus, the faithful will be able to make a clear distinction between what a Christian conscience leads them to do in their own name as citizens, whether as individuals or in association, and what they do in the name of the church and in union with their shepherds." This next sentence is key. "The role and competence of the church being what it is, she must in no way be confused with the political community, nor bound to any political system, for she is at once a sign and a safeguard of the transcendence of the human person. In their powers, in their proper spheres, the political community and the church are mutually independent and self-governing. Yet by a different title, each serves the personal and social vocation of the same human beings. This service can be more effectively rendered for the good of all if each works better for wholesome mutual cooperation, depending on the circumstances of time and place. So the vision of the human community put forward by the Catholic Church is one that starts with the fact that all people are called to the same end, namely God himself. From this, the principle is that love of neighbor is inseparable from love of God. In his recent encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, which is very, very interesting, I'd commend this to any of you who are curious about what the Catholic Church is thinking about at the moment, because it covers not only a criticism of technology, but a criticism of global markets, a criticism of environmental degradation, and knits together in quite a long document what is a very extensive description of the contemporary world situation in light of the principle of love and the advancement of love and brotherhood between peoples. In Caritas in Veritate, Benedict XVI cites a variety of earlier encyclicals and the Compendium of Social Doctrine of the Church, which came out very recently in 2004. And he refers to shedding light, quote, upon humanity's journey towards unity, unquote. He also speaks of the importance of truth, quote, wherever it is manifested, unquote. And he says that that truth is the only possibility of what he refers to as integral human development. The mission of truth, he says, is something that the church can never renounce. Her social doctrine is a particular dimension of this proclamation. It is a service to the truth which sets us free. Open to the truth from whichever branch of knowledge it comes, the church's social doctrine receives it, assembles it into a unity, the fragments in which it is often found, and mediates it within the constantly changing life patterns of the society of peoples and nations. So clearly this is not just a Catholic project. It's part of a human journey involving all religions across communities, nations, and time. It's quite a breathtaking vision. It raises obvious questions. One of which is how is Christ affirmed in if all human communities are ultimately journeying together? At what point, from a Christian perspective, does the encounter with Christ occur? And I think that's something Christian groups will talk about. Within Islam, the insights that Catholicism is offering here in terms of the structuring of human communities and the limited role of government, is that useful? Is that a ground for conversation? I think it is. The principle of subsidiarity was touched upon yesterday by Mark Charlton, but I thought I'd add just a quick insight into it that comes from the works of George Weigel, who's quite a useful commentator on some of these things. And he uses the language of larger and smaller, that the principle of subsidiarity is that essentially a community of a higher order should not interfere in the internal life of a community of a lower order, depriving the latter of its functions, but rather should support it in case of need and help to coordinate its activity with the activities of the rest of society, always with a view to the common good. Now, the principle of subsidiarity is very important in relation to local initiatives, municipalities, school boards, education generally, the role of the family, to name a few. And you'll have already connected it to what I said earlier about civil society. Weigel points out that positively, the principle of subsidiarity means that all communities should encourage and enable people to exercise self-responsibilities, and larger communities should do this for smaller communities. Put another way, decision-making responsibility in society should rest at the lowest level commensurate with the effective pursuit of the common good. So this is a vision of society in which, for example, parents and families are encouraged by local school boards, not usurped by them. local school boards are encouraged by wider educational groupings, not usurped by them. And ultimately, the provincial ministry of education encourages the subordinate groupings, doesn't usurp them. It's very powerful because it's not how we tend to do things in our society. To give an example, I used to live on a small island in British Columbia, and our highways, our roads on that island, were determined by the provincial highways code without any attention to our local needs as a community. So we had a road built through the middle of the island that everybody used to refer to as the Coquihalla, which is the name given to a very large kind of highway in British Columbia. That's maybe appropriate for a very large place in British Columbia, but it's not appropriate for an island community. What was wrong with that? Well, the planning rules were being determined at the top level of the highways ministry and simply dropped all the way through to the local application with no consultation with the community and no sense of what the community actually needed locally. Okay. The other thing about subsidiarity and solidarity, which is the principle of cooperative encouragement and mutual life together, is this. That while citizens are obliged in conscience to follow the law, they are not obliged to follow all the directives of civil authorities where they are contrary to the demands of the moral order or the fundamental rights of persons or the teaching of the gospel. Refusing obedience to civil authorities when their demands are contrary to those of upright conscience is part of the moral law and part of the principle of solidarity. This is very important because insofar as the state ceases to endorse subsidiarity and the solidarity, it tends to leave the individual without the groupings of dissent that are essential, that are a part of the mediating groupings of society between the individual and the state. In other words, one of the resistances to the Marxist-Leninist conception of the omnicompetent state is a stronger recognition of associational differences and diversity. Now, this will tie in a minute with how religions deal with minority religious groupings in their presence, and that brings me to the practical part of my paper. In South Africa, the Constitutional Court has said things about religion that have never been said in a Canadian case on religion. Here's what the Constitutional Court said in a decision about a decade ago called Christian Education. For many believers, their relationship with God or creation is central to all their activities. It concerns their capacity to relate in an intensely meaningful fashion to their sense of themselves, their community, and their universe. For millions in all walks of life, religion provides support and nurture and a framework for individual and social stability and growth. Religious belief has the capacity to awake concepts of self-worth and human dignity, which form the cornerstone of human rights. It affects the believer's view of society and founds the distinction between right and wrong. Nothing like that has ever occurred in Canadian case law. What is it about South Africa that produced that kind of insight from the judges? Well, I want to share with you an experience that I've been through the last couple of years. David Goa referred to it in the introductory comments. That experience has been the drafting of a South African Charter of Religious Rights and Freedoms, which was signed by every major religion in South Africa on October 21st, 2010 in Johannesburg. I was privileged to be one of the drafters of that document, and I can tell you that we had very little opposition from the religions. Why? The reason was because the culture is in crisis. The endemic poverty, the extraordinary difficulty the government has had in dealing with lack of employment, with terrible poverty, and so on, has created a situation of crime that is so serious it affects everybody. And stability is not part of that culture. Security is not part of that culture. And the courts have recognized the role religions play in forming the moral character of citizenship. And so have the religions are aware of their responsibility in this. So when they were given the chance to come together around a set of core principles that affirmed the role of religion in the society, they did so readily. The conversation was at a high level of intensity and maturity. And within 2 years, and lots of amendments, lots of conversation, the document was formed and signed. And it contains language in the recitals that refer to love and compassion, that use not language that you don't typically find in legal documents, but that you need to find in documents that have a more holistic conception of the human person and community. The document will become law only after it goes through the next phase, which is negotiation with the ANC. Now, just quickly, the experience in South Africa has an analog in Canada, but not in relation to a formulation of a law, but rather the cooperation that's been necessary around litigation. And Canada has had for many years interfaith cooperation in cases that have gone, certain kinds of cases, to the Supreme Court of Canada and provincial appellate courts. The first of these, apart from conversations relating to the charter being formed in 1982 and before that, was in relation to the abortion issue when an interfaith coalition appeared on the Borowski case. Similarly, on same-sex marriage, a coalition was formed, and I was one of the counsel for that interfaith coalition that took a position to ensure that religious communities' views of marriage as male and female would be stigmatized as unacceptable in Canada, that religions would still be allowed to have their own conception of ontology, male and female, in relation to marriage. Coalition. And I have some copies of my paper here, which goes into this in much more detail. But that coalition was made up of national associations of Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, and all the Catholic, Protestant denominations, and the Catholic bishops as well. We couldn't get Jewish membership, but a leading Jewish rabbi, David Novak from University of Toronto, filed an affidavit setting out the Jewish position, but no Jewish group would join that coalition for a variety of reasons. So in healthcare in British Columbia, the government some years ago sought to restructure, and there was a suggestion they were going to get rid of denominational healthcare, which at that time was largely consisted of Jewish long-term care facilities, United Church of Canada care facilities, and Catholic acute care hospitals and related health care. That group of concerned religious groups formed a denominational health care facilities association and negotiated with the government. I was one of the lawyers who worked with them, and we produced a master agreement on denominational health care in British Columbia. It was the first of its kind in Canada. And it recognized and protected the distinctive denominational understanding of healthcare principles within British Columbia's, at that time, changing healthcare financing and so forth. Religious concerns are often overlooked because the state perceives neutrality as non-religiousness. So they would say something like this in a public hospital. The questioning of a person coming into the hospital as to their denominational belief or their religious belief is not neutral. It's a request about religious adherence. Therefore, the neutral state shouldn't ask it. The problem with this is, what that then does is it means that the religions can't identify their people in the hospital for the purposes of chaplaincy visits or religious visitations, because the only way they knew who was there was the pastor or the minister or the imam would be able to go into the hospital and say, who are the Muslims, who are the Protestants, who are the Catholics. The secular, quote-unquote, the non-religious state perceived the removal of the question as neutral. But clearly it isn't. And what we need to do in all our language in these religious communities is we need to reconfigure it. Everyone's a believer. not just religious people. The question is, what do they believe in, not whether they're believers. So once you understand that simple truth and start to reconfigure the public sphere as a realm of competing belief systems, with atheism and agnosticism as belief systems, you're on a completely different paradigmatic frame base than you are if you buy into the idea of the secular. I advocate never using the term secular anymore. It has no purpose. It just confuses dialogue. Secularism is an ideology. There's no point trying to use secularism in a friendly or open way either. Here I disagree quite strongly with Charles Taylor's attempt to do that. I say that's like seeking a healthy botulism. Okay, in conclusion, every institution is inspired, at least implicitly, by a vision of human being and our destiny. From this vision, we derive the points of reference for our judgments, for our hierarchy of principles in relation to it, and the lines of conduct that flow from it. The Catechism of the Catholic Church points out that societies that do not recognize this vision, that's the inspired truth about God and humans, societies that don't recognize that vision or reject it in the name of their independence from God are brought to seek their criteria and goal in themselves or to borrow them from some ideology. Since they do not admit that one can defend an objective criterion of good and evil, they arrogate to themselves an explicit or implicit totalitarian power over man and his destiny, as history shows. Against this warning, the Church witnesses to and insists upon principles that maintain a place for persons in relations and communities of difference. In other words, a place for diversity. And yet it is not aimlessness. There is a vision at work here. A vision of unity, but not a convergence forced by law and politics, but chosen by the free will of men and women. Law and politics can achieve forced convergences only by committing violence against freedom. The Catholic vision of civic ordering limits civil authority and law. Subsidiarity erects places of difference and diversity through mediating institutions and instantiation of the principles of accommodation. These stand against a uniformity that, if imposed from above rather than proposed from below, will destroy it. Law as imposition and religions as proposition need to be in relation to each other. This relation, however, demands a recognition of the key differences not only to the jurisdictions, but the kind of force, persuasion versus coercion, that are essential to each. The long history of human communities have shown us that theocracy corrupts religions. Within the Catholic tradition in the Second Vatican Council, as I touched on earlier, in Dignitatis Humanae, 1965, the limits on religion in relation to the state were finally brought fully into Catholic doctrine within the understanding of development. This concept of development and the jurisdiction and limits of religion in relation to the state, law, and politics need to be learned within other religions as well. Government has a role to, quote, safeguard the religious freedom of all its citizens, unquote. And part of this freedom is that it, quote, must not hinder men or women from joining or leaving a religious body, unquote. The right to join and leave a religion without persecution was recently recognized by, as I said, all the religions in South Africa when they signed that charter. And as I mentioned, the Muslim Council of South Africa signed that. Well, that's important news for many people because one of the images of Islam that is very much prevalent in the West is that it does not accept the idea of exit, which is the right of exit or the ability to leave without persecution. So some statement or wider understanding globally about Islam as honoring the freedom of choice and conscience to choose against it, which is a paradoxical freedom, I suppose, but one that seems to be important, would go a long way, I think, to alleviate certain tensions and concerns about Islam as they're often expressed in the West. Law has its public role, but so does religion, yet they are different. Speaking truth to power is influenced by the means chosen to do the speaking. Theocracy seems to corrupt religious proposition by using the instruments of coercion that are essential to law. On the other hand, when law extends beyond its proper boundaries into the areas that should be reserved for families and associations in relation to religious liberty, it too is corrupted. The current phase in constitutional democracies is one of a kind of tug of war between convergence and accommodation of difference, between subsidiarity and statism. For this reason, there is a cooperation that is both practical and principled. Practical, because the concerns of any threatened subsidium is a concern of all, and principled, because the affirmation of freedom and conscience demands respect for others. Just as encyclicals in the Roman Catholic tradition are also directed to all men and women of goodwill, so the cooperative decisions in defense and support of others are necessary steps on the road to living together with disagreement and respect. History shows the difficulties of this vision, but perhaps wisdom and hope, the union of natural and supernatural insight, are the only road to a more harmonious coexistence. I'd like to close with a poem. There is a dove hovering in a dome, a stranger walking far from home. Heat glimmered on a desert path, and on the perfumed air a chant, a call to prayer. No east or west, no north or south, a wet cloth on a fevered brow, the same and different dove on a stone-curved dome, and all the world traversed is home. Thank you.